CF United, the premier Cold Fusion Conference by TerraTech Programming. Created by developers for developers.
So, objects and persistence. How many people here are using CFCs? Excellent, okay. So, as you've moved from doing the sort of old school stuff that we used to know how to do, where you have your procedural pages with your SQL embedded, and you've moved to your more structured code, one of the things that I find fairly common out there is people saying, you know, I used to know how to do this, I used to just put SQL code in, and now I have all these CFCs, I'm not really quite sure how I should be organizing my SQL code and getting stuff in and out of my objects and back to the database. And it seems like as soon as we change the format of the pages that we work with, we forget things that we've known all along. So what I want to do is to go through some of the issues you can fall into with Cold Fusion components as you're trying to do your persistence, and look at the fact that databases and database tables don't just necessarily map to objects and CFCs, and show some examples of why you don't have direct mapping. And of course, I also want to show ways to make life a lot easier and automate this. For those of you who don't know me, I am a team lead on the hosted services group at Adobe. That's the group that's responsible for Breeze Central and for PDF services online. So we're essentially bringing products and services to the web. It's a fairly new role. I was previously the senior architect for Macromedia's IT division for about 5 years and was very heavily involved with Macromedia.com and the drive to create a Cold Fusion-powered site. I've been doing this for quite a long time, but I'm a relative newbie to Cold Fusion. I only started doing Cold Fusion after Macromedia bought Allaire. So, you know, I find myself in this slightly strange position that I have an audience full of people who often have a lot more experience with Cold Fusion than I do. So, you know, you have to bear with me sometimes on my Cold Fusion. What I'm going to do is make sure everyone's on the same page by going through some definitions. It's kind of the boring bit, but we all need to be using the same terminology. And then I'm going to look at sort of persisting objects with objects and some of the issues that crop up there, relationships between tables, relationships between objects and mappings, and then look at one framework in particular. But I've got information in here about multiple frameworks, and I will encourage you to go out and research the frameworks yourself. And I'm actually going to show some code right at the end, and that way if I run out of time, you get to see less code, but you can go download it from my blog. So first of all, I want to cover some basic terms and make sure that we all have common vocabulary. One of the problems we can get into is simply just not using what is a commonly accepted definition for a term. And so typical ones that we need to know about are listed here, and the first one is a huge peeve of mine. Memory is not persistent. It goes away when you switch the machine off. I know the documentation uses persistent for scopes like application, but really, it's a shared scope. Persistence is when you put it somewhere, you can switch the power off, you switch the power back on, and the data's still there. So basically, it's disks, and as someone pointed out the other day, it's static memory. Or battery-backed memory, whatever, that no one puts gigabytes of databases on. So just a big pet peeve of mine, but I cringe every time I see someone call a scope persistent. CRUD is a common acronym you'll hear, and it's really just create, read, update, delete. So it's the four basic persistence operations. Creating a record in the database, reading a record from the database, updating a record in the database, and deleting a record from the database. And bean is a term that you'll have heard at a lot of talks this time around. We get it originally from the Java world, where they talk about a Java bean. It's kind of a pun. But really all it means is a structure on steroids. It's a struct that you can't just poke data in and out of. You use get methods to get the data out, and you set methods to put the data in. Why is this useful? Because you can create a bean, initialize it with all your data. You can have the get methods be public and the set methods be private, which means that once it's created, it can be passed around your application and nothing else can change it, so it becomes read-only. So it's a good way to ensure integrity of your data. It's also a convenient way to pass data around. And DAO, Data Access Object, essentially a data access object is going to provide the CRUD operations for a particular type. So if you have a person bean, person object, you're probably going to have a person DAO that is responsible for the persistence operations of a given person. So you might have one person DAO in your application, it's a service, and then you might have multiple people. So you might have a person Joe and a person Sandy, and you can interact with those and take them in and out of the database using the single data access object. One thing that you will see is that quite often people will combine the idea of an update or a create into a single save method so that the application doesn't really have to remember. And then the data access object looks inside and says, do you have a primary key? No. Okay, you must be a new object. I'll go put you in the database and give you a primary key. Oh, yes, you do. Okay, I'm going to update the row that you belong to. It's a good convenience, and it takes out some of that conditional tedium elsewhere in your application. I think gateway, which has a number of names, people often just refer to a gateway object. Sometimes they'll say a data gateway. Sometimes they'll even say a table data gateway. The idea is that it's all of those persistence operations that don't relate to a single object. So it's your general sort of list operations, your searches, bulk updates, bulk deletes. And typically, you'll have the methods in a gateway returning a query object. So you'll transact in individual objects for your DAOs, but with a gateway, you're looking at sets of data. And Cold Fusion has a really good encapsulation of the raw data. It's called a query. We're used to using it all the time. We can iterate over it, and it understands how to get the columns out. So what's common in the Java world is to take your record set and convert it to an array of objects immediately. That's a fairly expensive operation in some situations, and if all you're going to do is display a master list page where perhaps you show three or four columns out of 20 or 30 in your database, and then you click on one and drill down into a page that shows all 20 or 30 fields, why would you want to create an object for every single row on that front page? Now, having said that, if you're dealing with Flex, the way that it works is it assumes you are going to create an array of objects, because generally you're going to pass the whole lot once to Flex, and then it's going to deal with things like sorting and mapping of data in the client. So there are situations where you will want to convert things to an array of objects. But in general, in most of the HTML applications we're creating, you just use record sets. It's easier. And ORM, object relational mapping. And that's really just a fancy way of saying that what we store in the database is not always what we have in our objects. It might be as simple as mapping between the table name, and I know that people dealing with legacy databases have some pretty gnarly table names to deal with. DBAs have a strange habit of putting prefixes on, and underscores, and suffixes, and sometimes you see them with numbers in that indicate entities that came off the original design diagrams. So mapping of names in columns, field label, mapping of multiple tables and relationships. So that's all object relational mapping. So what I want to do is to sort of walk through the sort of old school traditional page-based embedded SQL way of doing a very simple application and show how you would gradually migrate that to using Cold Fusion components and then to using sort of full data access objects and beans and gateways. So in the old school way, we might have an edit.cfm page. And at the top of the page, we'd have our query to go and get the item based on the ID, the primary key. And then we'd have a form, and we would put item name, item details in the form. And we'd have it post back to a save page, or you might have it post back to the same page. And the save operation would go through and do an update, and then would perhaps relocate back to your list page. If we want to move forward and move towards CFCs, one of the first steps we might take is to simply take all of those queries out of our display pages and put them somewhere else, put them in a Cold Fusion component. And then at least your pages are only going to call the Cold Fusion component. So you might just have one CFC, just stick all of your SQL in there, give those all method names, and then call it. So if we look on the right, we'll see we've created an item storage CFC, and it has a getItem method. We pass in a key, and it does just the same query as it did before and returns the query object. So I'm only going to have one record in, but this is just a first step. Our edit.cfm page now calls getItem on this storage object that lives in application scope. So at least we've now taken all of our SQL out of our pages and put it in one place. So it's encapsulated all of our database activity, and if we needed to change the way the database is, perhaps the column layout, perhaps, heaven forbid, you're moving from one database type to another, and it actually happens a little bit more often than people think, you've only got one place to go instead of having to open up every single template in your application and look at the query tags. So it's a good first step. The next step with that is to say, okay, instead of just dealing with raw query objects when I've got one of them, I'll have a bean. And so we'd have an item CFC, which is our bean, and it'll have get and set methods, like get name, get description, so on. And we now have an item data access object that is set up to transact in items. So when we get an item, instead of returning a query, we would go and do the same query we did before. We'd get our one record, but we'd actually create an object of that type and return an initialized object of that type. Very little changes in the edit page. It's now referring to a data access object, and it's now making method calls. But already we have some benefit, because at this point we're no longer dealing with the raw column names in the database. So if you have funky table names and funky column names, you've been able to hide all of that away, and your code can now transact in clean, well-written names that make your code a lot easier to work with. So at this point, you've got one object, data access object per table, because this is kind of just a linear thing. We've just mapped from raw queries to raw data access objects. I'm going to expand on that and show that that's not always the case. But I know that for a lot of the applications we write, that is the case. And of course, the question is, what about things like list operations? If you really only have one list operation, it's kind of okay to slide it into the data access object. And actually, I've done that in the code examples, because all I do is just list. I just say, get me all of them. And I didn't want to write a separate CFC. So don't think that it's completely black and white, and you absolutely have to write things the right way and always have a gateway and always have a data access object. You're allowed to bend the rules a little bit. If not doing so would make your code worse. So are you always going to have one data access object per table? In most cases, probably. But remember that a data access object is geared to an object. So if you have a person object, you have a person data access object. But you might actually be storing that across multiple tables. Or you could have a situation where you actually have multiple object types stored within a single table. I'm going to go through some of those examples. On what is now Adobe.com, it was Macromedia.com when I wrote the slides, the membership object, when you log in and it pulls your data from the database, we actually have a core user table that has basic profile information in, and then we have a set of extended attributes. So depending on what you're doing on the site, we may pull in extra attributes and put them in a single user object. So we have a data access object that deals with that member object, but when it's persisting, what it's actually doing is interacting with multiple tables. So if you change your edge preferences, for example, those might be off in a separate table. And so the application doesn't need to worry about it. It doesn't care about the structure of the database. It just deals with members. So that's nice and clean. I go through some examples that are actually, unfortunately, real examples in one of the systems at Macromedia a while back. I worked on our ERP system. Now, anyone who's worked on sort of the big back-end systems knows that they really do tend to have some pretty nasty database structures. We actually had a table in there that was just columns out the wazoo and named things like bill to street, bill to city, and of course it had ship to street, ship to city, ship to state, and deliver to city, deliver to street, deliver to state, and so on, all just in one big table. And so as a first cut for dealing with this, we had a customer object that had all of those attributes just renamed to have, you know, nice mixed case, no underscores, and then get and set methods that we're dealing with on those. So it was a very simple one-to-one mapping. But it was a really ugly object because it was this long just in terms of method signatures. So what we did was we broke it up into a customer object and then an address object for each of the three types of address. And so we have a bill to address, ship to address, and a deliver to address. And the address has street, city, state. And we've now hidden those column names completely. And the application is behaving much more readably because it actually has an address object that we can pass off to some function that deals with addresses. And we couldn't do that before because the method names reflected the columns in the database. So you could only pass in individual parts of the address, and the calling code had to go and get them from the object. But now you can actually pass addresses around inside the application. So again, we've abstracted away from the database, and the mapping now has multiple objects going into a single table. And then, as I say, going back to the membership object, this is kind of the other way around. This is the multiple tables, single object approach. And again, you can hide it completely by having your sort of customer data access object interacting with those multiple tables. And the nice thing is this actually allows you to change your database structure and only change the data access tier. So you can change your application to use a better object model without having to change your database structure. You can change your database structure without having to change all of your application. You just change the data layer. The other thing to be aware of is that because objects exist in memory and tables exist in the database, the navigation structures are going to be different. If you have a bunch of objects in memory, you can navigate through related objects using method calls. So if you have a person and it has a home address, you can say get home address, and you'll be given back an address object. So you're navigating through this related graph of objects. If you're looking at database work, then you actually have to have a key in each table, and you have to explicitly walk through the keys. Now, what that means is in order to be able to take your objects in and out of the database, the objects actually need to know about the database keys. It's one of those unfortunate artifacts. And so pretty much any persistent object is going to have the primary key from the database held inside it somewhere, even if you never use it inside your application, just because that's the easiest way to do it. And as you can see there in this example, the person table would have its primary key and an address, home address ID, foreign key into the address table. And in picture format, when you have a one-to-one relationship, you have your object A referring to object B through a reference, and your table with a foreign key, which refers to the primary key in the other table. If we have a one-to-N relationship, where we have, we would refer to it through an object that has an array or a structure with references to the other objects. And you would get a collection, and you can walk through the collection, or you can index into it, and you manipulate it the way that you would manipulate any regular ColdFusion data structures. And in the database, we might now have the other situation where we have a set of foreign keys in the related table referring back to a primary key in the parent table. So what we see here is by going to a one-to-N relationship in the object world, it's still much the same. You go from the parent object down to the children. But in the database, you may well have the relationship reversed. And then, of course, in a many-to-many relationship, you have the situation that parent objects will have arrays or structs referring to their children, and the children, in turn, will also have arrays or structs referring back to the parents. But in the database, you can't do that kind of stuff, so you typically have linking tables where you will have sets of foreign keys pointing out to the related entries in those tables. So in this example, you have two objects in the A table, two records in the A table, you have three records in the B table, and you have six foreign key pairs in the linking table. And one thing to note, and I sometimes point this out and sometimes forget, obviously if you're in memory and you're dealing with multiple relationships like this, your natural instinct is, well, I'm going to have an array of the child objects. And one of the tricks that I've tended to do is to actually use a struct but to use indexes that are that look numeric. And the reason for this is that when you deal with arrays in ColdFusion, the array itself is actually passed by value. And when you assign an array, it actually copies the array. It doesn't copy what's in it. It'll still point to the same objects, but it actually will copy the array every time you refer to it. And so I know I don't promote optimization before you know there's a problem, but I have tended to switch away from arrays and use structures because when you're copying them around, you're keeping references to them. And that allows you, if you need to modify the original. If you're dealing with arrays, you actually get into the situation where you create a copy accidentally. You might modify it and wonder why you're not updating the original. And it came up originally in a class that Hal Helms and Ben Edwards taught about Mark II. They came to Macromedia, they ran the training course to get our engineers up to speed on Mark II. And we were working through one of the examples, and it involved a shopping cart with an array of items in the shopping cart. And as it was first coded, it used an array, it returned an array, and then was updating things in the array, and actually had to have a set method to put the whole array back in. It turns out that if you mess with arrays and you mess with some of the array methods, you'll find that there are actually situations where it behaves as if you have a reference to the original array, and you modify it, and it will update the original array, and other cases where it will take a copy. And that can be really nasty and bite you. So that's partly why I've switched to structs. So just that's complete aside, nothing to do with this, but just something to go and think about. And I don't know about you, but I'm one of those people who hates writing SQL. I'm really not very good at it. And I had to confess to a user group that I presented at just a little while ago that I have probably only written a handful of join statements in my life. I don't understand the difference between the different types of joins, so I don't write them. I write simple SQL statements. I show them to my colleagues, and when they stop laughing, they will suggest a better SQL statement for me. And I'm kind of like, great, that's what you guys are for. I don't have to know all this stuff because I have colleagues who do know this stuff. So I'm not ashamed to admit that I'm a lousy SQL programmer. But I really would prefer something where I don't actually have to write any SQL at all, to have something else do it for me. And as you probably already know, for some of you who've certainly seen any of Joe's presentations, you don't have to write SQL to be able to build applications that interact with databases. So, of course, big proponent of frameworks, I'm going to tell you here's where frameworks can help you. And I wrote this presentation originally because towards the end of last year, there was just suddenly an explosion in this space. Four frameworks appeared that did object relational mapping to some degree, automatic persistence. They were of differing capacities. Now, in fact, they've all sort of come a bit more in line. They've all developed quite a bit since I originally wrote the presentation. But you're able to specify relationships between the tables. In some of them, you're actually able to specify mappings of column names and field names. And some of them let you extend the sort of the record objects to create full-blown business objects in different ways. But I will comment that most of these are typically table-based, so they work best with one-to-one object-to-table mappings. The four that sprang up, you're never going to live this one down, Joe. Inspired by Ruby on Rails, the active record of Ruby on Rails, we have the ARF Active Record Factory from Joe Reinhardt, which has kind of gone quietly away. But this presentation is an unpleasant reminder that he once created an active record factory. Nick Tunney's Object Breeze. Is Nick here? Okay, well, he's here at the conference. Mark Mandel, who is in Australia and can't come to the conference, wrote one called Transfer. And Doug Hughes, who also unfortunately can't be here, wrote Reactor, which is now working very closely with Model Glue 2. So I'm going to go through an overview of these four just to give you some idea of the variety and to point out that Object Breeze, Transfer, and Reactor are all being actively developed. So whilst you may jump in on Model Glue 2 and therefore Reactor, it's still worth going and looking at the others to see different viewpoints on how to make this sort of thing work. And if you're not going to use one of those frameworks, it might give you some ideas for how you might want to automate some of this process yourself. UFF was inspired by Rails. It has something called an active directory, active record. It was very basic sort of data access object and gateway support. You defined a skeleton CFC yourself, and then the system kind of used that and used the table to build the live objects. And there were video tutorials and a good quick start. And is it still downloadable? You've hidden it away, haven't you? I've got a copy of it I can give people.
You can support it.
Oh, it's open source. That's true, yes. Anyone could take it on and support it. Object Breeze took a slightly different approach, mostly in terms of its API. Again, it had basic data access object and gateways. It had a query object iterator, which was added in one of the early revisions of it. And it didn't have any validation support, which some of the other frameworks do. The interesting thing was you didn't actually have to define any XML files or any CFCs sort of skeletons. You pointed it at the database, it got a basic metadata, and then you actually did method calls to define the relationship. So in code at your startup, you'd say, well, I've got a person object, and I've got an address object, and the person has an address. And you do method calls to make that happen. One of the things that is unique about it is it worked very tightly with the idea of a collection of objects. So instead of just saying, okay, well, you've just got an iterator and you can walk over these things, or you've got a query of the results, it said, no, we've got a real collection of real objects. And so if you'd got this set of objects and you went in and you modified, you know, object number 2 and you modified number 4 and you added a new object, and you could then say to the collection, okay, save yourself. And it would go in and figure out which ones had changed, which ones had been deleted, which ones had been added, and modify the database accordingly. So it can actually do bulk updates, deletes, and inserts based on collections, which is pretty nice. And that, I can't remember what level that's got to now. It's a pity Nick's not here to be able to correct me. When I presented this to my local user group, he was on Breeze and was popping up and correcting me on things. And then transfer from Mark Mandel. Now, this, again, takes a very different approach. The idea behind this wasn't so much just simple, persistent beans, but a way to have business objects which just happened to know how to persist themselves. And so one of the key things was that in your XML file that defined the objects and the relationships, you could actually go in and actually define full-blown ColdFusion methods in there. And then when it generated the code, it would just insert that into the generated code. So its way of letting you build these business objects was essentially to write your CFML code into an XML file, and then it would just generate code that had the additional persistence machinery added. And it had a pretty sophisticated event model where you could tie into all the before and afters of create, read, update, delete. And you might think, well, why would I want to do that? Think of a system where you're creating invoices. Every time a new invoice is created, you might want to trigger a process that does something with that invoice. You want to kick off something else in the application. Now, normally, you'd have to explicitly hook that in and program the logic up. But the event model lets you do things like, well, I'll just create the invoice, and I'll just save it to the database. Another piece of code which you've said, well, you know, before you save any one of these, let me know, is triggered automatically by the framework, and then it can go off and kick off the workflows. And I think that's up to version 0.5 now. Thank you. Yeah, 0.5. And then there's Reactor. And we were debating the other day on chat about which one of these came first, and they did all come out roughly around the same time when they first hit public light. Some of them have been talked about longer than others. But finding the original date of some of these is rather hard now, so I don't know quite what our ORM history is going to say about this. Reactor has separate data access objects, gateways. It has built-in validation, so it will introspect your database, figure out the types of the database columns, and let you do validation of your data against the inbuilt data type. So you can actually say, will this fit in the database? Are these strings short enough to fit in the tables? Is this really a date? And so on. So that's very, very nice that it's completely automatic. Now, it's not going to do all of your validation needs, but it's going to ensure that, for the most part, at least you can insert it in the database without getting an error. It uses XML configuration mostly to define the relationships between objects. This comment, I think, cropped up in your talk earlier this morning when someone asked whether it could automatically introspect foreign key relationships. And because it's a multi-database framework, it's very, very hard to do that in any generic way that's meaningful. So just because one particular database lets you define all of the metadata inside the database, not all databases do. And some databases are only just getting support for things like, you know, stored procedures and other stuff like that. So providing anything that's generic enough to work across multiple databases, there's going to be some sacrifices in what level of automation it can provide. What Reactor does, though, with the XML configuration file is it uses it with some other information to generate CFCs using XSL. It's a very nice use of XSL. Even if you're not going to use Reactor, it's probably worth going and looking at the way it generates code if you're interested in how XSL can be used. It introspects the database using database-specific commands, but it relies as much as possible on the sort of the native support in that database, and you really only need to create two files if you want to support a new database. It has a conventions file and an object DAO, which is basically how you introspect the structure of a table, and the convention says how you write certain types of columns and certain types of constructs within the SQL, which differ slightly from database to database. And it still has an event model of sorts, although it's been changed dramatically as the framework's evolved, because in order to do certain more sophisticated operations, it's very hard to support a generic event model across everything it can do. It allows aliasing of tables, columns, it supports multi-table linking relationships, so it implicitly understands that idea of having that link table with the multiple foreign keys. You also have a full object representation of essentially prepared queries. You can build a query object, you can add where clauses to it, all using method calls, and build this object representation of a query that's completely database independent. And then you can say, okay, go off and execute my query, and it will figure out what SQL it needs to generate for the specific database and do the right thing for your database. There is now quite a lot of documentation because there's a docs.reactorframework.org, I think it is, or live docs. One of them was live docs, one of them was docs. And it has a great sample app, the blog app, which Doug actually runs his own site on. And I know that some other people are now beginning to put up the Reactor blog as their live blog. So even if you've got a blog, go look at it. It's a good application. It uses, is it FCK editor or is it at the Tiny Mice in that one? Anyone know? FCK? It's a pretty full-featured blog. It allows you to write articles. It's got a pretty nice layout. So it is very full function, and it's a good sample app. It's probably one of the best sample apps that any of the frameworks have at the moment. And it's available via Subversion and for download. It's got a bug tracker, and it has very active development going on, a very active mailing list. So to sum up on the unique selling points for these, ARF was by far the simplest. It was sort of quick and dirty, broad database support because it used basic JDBC metadata, and it is deprecated. It's hard to find now because other things have come along, and Joe quite rightly does not want to continue supporting that in the face of all that competition. Object Breeze was the first one to go 1.0, I believe, some time ago, and the explicit object collection management is a very interesting feature in that. And Nick continues to work on this framework, so expect it to continue evolving. I know that he's using it extensively for what he's working on, and therefore he's going to keep evolving it for his own needs and just making it available. Transfer, definitely a very interesting framework to look at, and Mark continues to work on this, despite my constant ragging on him that he should help with Reactor instead. And then there's Reactor itself, which is full-featured and robust and has gone through a lot of work to address performance issues, because obviously all these frameworks have some performance overhead because of the metadata introspection they're doing. So very, very active development on this. So what I want to do, first off, is Peter Bell in the room? No. Okay. I'm not asking that so I can say anything controversial about him. Peter is a very strong advocate of code generation. Rather than using a framework that kind of sits inside your application and sort of magically assists you along, Peter is in the school with several other people who think that having something generate code for you, and then you take that code and work with that as your application and extend it and enhance it, is a more appropriate approach. In fact, CF on wheels kind of works that way, that you crank the handle and code comes out, and then you take the code and you do something with it. There's quite a few sort of persistence type generators out there. One that I found while I was looking around was a plugin for HomeSite. So for the HomeSite users, Stan Winchester's CFC generator, which I haven't used HomeSite because it's Mac, although I have now got Windows XP, so I ought to install HomeSite on it, I suppose. Plugs into HomeSite, you point it at a database table, and it will generate CRUD CFCs for you. And I gave this presentation to the Portland user group, and I didn't know that Stan Winchester was a member of the Portland user group, and he was sat right down the front when I was talking about it. And I'd got the wrong URL in here. And so he just piped up and gave me this URL and asked me why I'd picked it. And I said, well, you know, I went out and did a search for CRUD code generators, and this actually was the one that came up with the most hits at the time. And, you know, I'd never heard of it, never heard of him, but there you go. So go out, look around. If you don't want to use a framework that's doing a lot of magic for you, look at code generators. And if you find Peter Bell here at the conference, he would love to talk to you about code generation. He has a blog that has some fascinating stuff on it, some very sort of advanced ideas about code generation and metaprogramming. And I encourage you to track that down and to read that. I blogged about it the other day. Definitely a good read. Now, I will note that some of the ORM frameworks actually work by code generation under the hood. Transfer works by taking XML files and transforming them into CFCs in a way that lets you take parts of the XML file and just drop them in, essentially. Reactor works by generating CFCs for you. And what it does is it generates shell CFCs that extend the base generated code. Does it once, never overwrites it. So if you need to override any of the functionality or to add your own methods, you can go into those generated shell CFCs and you can actually add in any code you want. So you can replace a method by overriding it. You can therefore put your own custom SQL into the method if you want to do tuning. You could add your business functions in there if you've got something that needs more than just simple getters and setters. Now I'm going to go through some code examples. It's a wiki application. Some of you will probably know that I don't think very much of wikis. I think wikis should be kept behind locked doors. Because when they're out in the open, they're subject to vandalism. And in fact, Doug had a problem that he put up a wiki for Reactor and had to take it down because it was repeatedly vandalized. As many of you know, I've been working on the Fusebox 5 project. You can come and get the release candidate from me at any time you want. It's also up on fusebox.org. And I'm using Track, which Simeon Bateman hosts, which is a bug tracker, and it's also a wiki. And about once a week, once every 2 weeks, the pages on the wiki get vandalized, and we have to go in and revert them. So I don't like wikis all that much. They're really good for behind-the-firewall internal systems, though. However, it's a good application to do very, very simple persistence with. So what I've done, and you can download the code from my blog, is I have a traditional page-based application with embedded SQL, and then I have a version of it that uses CFCs and a version that uses DAOs and the gateways and so on. And then I have a version with each of the four frameworks. So that's a total of seven, six, however many. Seven. I don't do math very well. Now, one thing I will comment on is that the data access objects in these examples do have a list method, which, as I said earlier, isn't necessarily best practice, but this is kind of just a demo app. And what I'll do is I'll go through each of the code applications and show it running and show you the progression of the code. So in the first variant, as you can see, we've got an index page, we've got a list page, an edit page, which is the edit form I was referring to, a save page, and an application CFC. Well, I wrote it on CF7, so naturally used application CFC. If we look at the index page, we'll see that right at the top, it starts with the query. So this is sort of traditional old school SQL in your pages. And then it does a bunch of nastiness down here, which is all the wiki stuff. But essentially, it's just going through and pulling out columns directly out of the record that comes back. And if we look at the list for this, which is the list of those records, again, we have the query at the top of the page, and then we simply loop through the record set that we get back, writing out rows in the table. So very traditional stuff. Let's see it running. That'll teach me to press the wrong button. Okay, let's see it running. There we go. Here's our browser. So here's the wiki, and we can edit this page. So we can see it's really working on the database, nice and fast, because it's not got any frameworks in. It's just SQL code in there. And we can go and list all the pages and jump around in here and so on. The second version has actually introduced a CFC that contains all of the SQL. And so it's really just got a bunch of methods in here that mostly just have the queries in that used to be in the pages. So all we've done with the code is move it from one place to another. They're the exact same queries. If we look at the list, we now see that it's saying to this, it's not really a data access object in this case, it's just the storage object, go and get me a list of these things, and it comes back as a query. If we look in the index page, we'll see again it's just saying, go and read an item from the database for me. But it's still coming back as a query. We're still talking to record sets, record count, and definition. So it's just the first step. But it's already helped by moving all of that SQL off into one other place. So this is already a more maintainable approach than the sort of traditional SQL in your page version. If we look at the third variant, we'll see that we've introduced a bean. Not very exciting. It has get ID and set ID. Get wiki term, set wiki term. Get definition and set definition. No smarts in it. It's just a place for data, getting the data in and out. If we look at the pages, they're going to be very, very similar. In fact, the list simply returns the same query object that we've been dealing with in the previous one, so no change there. If we look at the index one, it looks the same, but now what we're doing is we're calling methods. So here, to find out it doesn't exist, we say get the primary key. Oh, it's zero. Therefore, we didn't get a record back, so nothing exists. Otherwise, we can get a definition out of it. The nice thing at this point, though, is I don't know if I actually do it on this particular page, but you can now get rid of that nasty wiki term column and call it just get term and map it in the data access object. One other thing I'll point out here is that in the save, we're able to just say save. Remember I said that we had the create, read, update, delete, but in a lot of cases we have just a simple save method. If we were to look in here, we see it deciding whether to do a create or update. And again, that's kind of code that you don't really need floating around your application when you can simply put it in the save method and have the save method be smart enough to decide whether or not it needs to do an insert or an update. So again, moving the code, the irrelevant code, out of your pages and down into the lower level. I'm not going to go through the ARF object breeze and transfer versions. As I say, you can download the code and go look at that for yourself. I am going to look at the Reactor version. So we see we still have the same page-based model, just to show you don't have to use the MVC frameworks to be using things like Reactor. We have a Reactor XML file. And all it has in it is that we didn't like the name of the database table, so we've given it an alias of wiki, and we didn't like the name of this particular field, so we've given that an alias of term. Now, I haven't aliased any of the other columns in there, because you only need to specify fields with an alias where you actually want to change the name. So I've left the other ones alone. I could have completely left out the object tag, and it would have used the default column and table names. So I've still got a data access object. Now, why is that? Why would I still want a data access object? Well, this actually was done to hide the structure of Reactor so that I didn't need to expose Reactor to the rest of the application, partly because I was building it as an example to show how it changes with each different framework. What that means is that internally, you can see that read by term is asking record to create a record using the alias and to load using the term that's passed in. If we're loading by ID, very similar. It just says I want to load using the ID field instead. And for the gateway, where we're doing a list, we say create a gateway object. Remember, that's one of those bulk objects. And we just do a get all sort by term. So still got the same sort of data access object, API to the rest of the world. And internally, we've implemented that in Reactor. And of course, the pages are going to be very, very similar. They don't look any different here to the other versions of the application, because I've hidden the actual API of Reactor inside this. The only place where I've exposed it is in the save, because I could have done this inside the data access object, but it's worth just showing how Reactor lets you interact with the beans as sort of smart, persistable entities. So I have my object. I go and look it up if it exists, and then I set the new term into it, I set the new definition into it, and then I say, save yourself. And if the key exists, it knows it's an update. If the key doesn't exist, it'll do an insert automatically, and I don't have to worry about it. And if you just want to see that there really is a Reactor version running, if we go to all pages and click on the index, you can see down here, oh, come on, here's the Reactor version. And just for the purposes of curiosity, I've actually put a page render time on this. So you can see that there is some overhead. I am actually running it in production mode on here. So you know, these frameworks do introduce a little bit of overhead, but we're still getting page render time on this of 100 milliseconds for what I'm working on. And it's actually got the whole table laid out. The main page is slightly misleading because, of course, what's really taking the time in here is all the wikiization of all the markup and turning that into HTML with all those regular expressions you saw in the index page. So again, it's one of those things where often in a lot of applications where they're doing a lot of work, the time taken is not going to be necessarily in the framework part of it, but actually in your own logic code. So don't get too hung up on the performance overhead of frameworks. So comments on the Reactor. I've used the data access object to wrap Reactor so it's not exposed to the rest of the application. The application creates a data access object. The data access object itself goes off and creates the Reactor factory. If you feel so inclined, of course, you can then swap out the implementation with other frameworks. It's also a good way that once you've gotten into that sort of bean and data access object mode, you can then migrate parts of your application to automated frameworks. So it's a good way to get a progression by building those layers in. The bean has essentially been replaced by what's an abstract record in Reactor terms that has the same sort of get set methods that we're used to. Comments about the DAO having no save method, we might as well let the bean be smart enough to save itself. And again, no SQL to do anything with the list. And in fact, you don't have to write SQL to do an awful lot of fairly complex things with Reactor. So as I said, the frameworks are going to help you not write SQL, but they're still going to be, for the most part, one-to-one mappings between your objects and your tables. Now, what about those situations where you have relationships where you have perhaps one object across multiple tables or multiple objects going into one table? Does that mean you can't use a framework to help automate that? Well, actually, you can. And the whole point of me doing the data access object separate from Reactor is that if your data access object knows that your object has to be persisted across multiple tables, under the hood, it can use Reactor to interact with those database tables. So in the example I gave from Acromedia.com, where we have a membership object, you would have a member DAO, and it would use Reactor to pull a record out of the member table, and then it would use Reactor to pull the matching records out of the extended profile table and still return a single member object. So now we have the benefit of not writing any SQL and still having the hidden sort of mapping between a single object and multiple tables. So if you've got a complex database structure and you want a different object model, You can still use frameworks to help you with this. You've just got to think about the differences in your object model design and your database table design. So that's why I say frameworks don't really do any object relational mapping. They let you do aliases, but they don't deal with a lot of the complex relationships. They deal with a certain level of them. It gets very, very hard to automate these operations. It's something that Doug's been struggling with React as he's made it more and more sophisticated. There's a limit to how much automation you can do. So don't just think that these things are going to completely obviate the need for you to write a data tier in your application. But having said that, they're very, very useful. If you actually sit down and think about your object model design for your application and build an object model that is going to be the easiest for you to manipulate in your application and to best represent the real world for your application, you can then separately go and think about how to design your database system to be as optimal as you want it to be. And if that means that you use multiple tables per object, or that you use tables that hold multiple types of objects, it doesn't matter. You can actually do those mappings. But it lets you write a very, very efficient persistence system with an optimized database and yet still have a very, very nice maintainable object model. Particularly true if you're dealing with legacy databases. How many people here have to write applications on top of legacy databases? Yeah, and how many of those databases have some real nastiness in that you wish didn't bleed into your application? Yeah. And probably today, that nastiness does actually bleed up into your application layer, I expect. So think about this as a way to hide all of that ugliness behind a well-designed object model. Okay, I'll open it up for questions.
Sure.
Down the front.
One of the things I really love about React is the ability to do cascading saves when objects have children objects and whatnot. And I appreciate the approach of having just kind of an EAM that you can create that's an interface to React. When you get into the complex relationships like that, when I want to save at the top level and have a cascade down through there, how do you manage those two things?
Okay, the question was, Reactor can manage cascading updates, but if you introduce a DAO layer yourself, how are you going to be able to take advantage of that cascading operation? And it's really tricky. It's a trade-off that you have to make, because that's where you've got a power in the framework to leverage some automation that actually runs counter to what you might want to do with your object model. So it's one of those terrible sort of gray areas where you have to say, okay, the framework buys me so much in this area that I'm simply not going to go to the trouble of creating an encapsulated mapping of it. I'm just going to expose it and let my application deal with it. But it's an important point to make because, you know, a lot of people don't realize that you can actually take advantage of that complete automation across those cascading systems. That's partly why the event model got watered down, because in order to make the cascading updates work, the event model couldn't be implemented as richly as it was in an earlier release. I think there was a question there.
It has a unique concept of obviously design and backing database relational database. Is there a benefit to using Postgres to use more? Because I know it's object relational
mapping. Okay. The question was Postgres has kind of some sort of object. It's an object relational database, so it actually already has some of the mappings. I don't know enough about it to comment. I've never used that database, and I have to say I don't know too many people who do. I know that the people who use it are very vociferous about it. Back in the day, when I was doing a lot of C++ development, object databases were kind of the next big thing that they kept telling us were coming. And there were some very, very sophisticated systems out there to deal with object persistence where you simply didn't need to worry about it. You just wrote objects, and you either tagged an object with some sort of annotation to say it's persistent, and then you just left the system to deal with it. And they had multi-level caches and a lot of very, very complex machinery inside them. But they never took off, despite what seemed to be obvious benefits. And I think the reason that they never took off was that people just simply had too many legacy databases, and it was too much of a change. And the inertia to move away from those relational models, particularly with all of the traditional relational model support, makes it very, very hard for things to, like that, to to get a foothold. So I think it's good that there is a database that has those functionality. I don't know what it would look like to implement an application on top of it. I don't know whether even in Cold Fusion you'd be able to take advantage of that through JDBC. Do you know? Okay, so it kind of hides the meta relationships between tables. It's like smart relationships. Okay, that's very interesting. I will have to go and look at that a bit more. Thank you. Another question? Jim?
You might want to mention at some point Adobe Labs has an RDS-based DAO and gateway generator for Eclipse available for download. I think it's in the Flex section there.
That's a good point. Jim has reminded me, remind all of us, that Adobe, we have put out their code generators. We have plugins for Eclipse. You can get them off the labs. I'm pretty sure you can get them from downloading Flex or the Cold Fusion connectivity tools. That if you're using Eclipse 3.1 or you're using Flex Builder 2, you can install these plugins, and it gives you access to RDS, which, of course, none of you have enabled on your production servers, I'm sure, but on your development servers, and you can browse your data sources, point at a table, and say, okay, generate me data access objects, generate me beans. And if you're dealing with Flex, it will generate you the full sort of Flex assembler, which is the piece that does all the bulk updates and synchronization. So there's those full code generators on there that the team have worked very, very hard on. So thank you for reminding me.
Persisting those objects or objects that are being passed around back into a shared scope object for persistence?
So the question is, are there special concerns around persisting objects that are being held in shared scopes? In general, I can't actually think of situations where you would be doing that, because the objects that you're keeping in shared scopes, particularly application scope or server scope, are being created at startup. And you might perhaps read some initial data from a database, but because it's not thread safe to be modifying those, you're not going to be generally modifying them and putting them back in the database. I know people who like to keep their configuration in a database and tend to do the sort of the startup read, but they don't do the modify and write back. If you have objects in session scope, certainly you're going to have situations where you might want to update those objects and mirror that back to the database. A good example is the Adobe.com shopping cart. If you're on the online store and you make changes to your cart, it actually will persist it to the database, as well as keeping it in memory. But because that's sort of a per-request update, there's no special machinery that you need to worry about there. And the benefit there is that the customer comes back a couple of days later if they've decided not to purchase the first time, and they don't have to go hunting around the site to find all their objects that are still in the cart. As far as I know, there's no specific issues to deal with other than the normal thing about, you know, multi-threaded access to shared scopes. Anyone else? Down here.
Does the generator react to allow you to generate inquiries if you wanted to have forms from the table and you can
do this? The question is, can you generate forms with Reactor? And the answer is no, it's out of the scope of Reactor. Reactor's very focused on persistence and mapping between objects and the database. If you want something that will automatically generate forms for your database tables, look at Model Glue 2, because it has scaffolding, and you can say, create a scaffold based on an object, a database table, and it will automatically generate you a display page, an edit form, a list page, and give you delete and update operations. And then you can take those and customize them. So Model Glue 2 will certainly do a lot of the automation, the sort of the initial heavy lifting of creating those forms. Anyone else? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening, and we hope we will see you at CF United 2007. This has been a production by TerraTech Programming. For more information, go to www.cfunited.com.